Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in the listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Jennifer, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Progress in the Treatment of Colorectal Cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. And we have on the call today over 619 participants, so there's really a lot of you on the call today. And you come from all over the United States, from many different regions and parts of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, India, Jordan, Taiwan, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a bit of a global call, and it's a credit that you're all spending the next hour with us. Now, today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb and ImClom Systems, a wholly owned subsidiary of Eli Lilly and Company. I really want to thank them for their support of this program. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about, of course, all of our speakers and the topics they'll be covering, and there also is information about all of our collaborating organizations as a resource to you. Now, there also is a brief evaluation form, and I would ask you all to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. You know, when you think about it, who but each of you can really tell us the programs and the topics we should be addressing in these workshops? You're our best consultants in terms of telling us what you need. Indeed, the focus on doing programs on colorectal cancer and being able to do more of them has been really come from your recommendations to us. You've asked us to do these topics, and so we offer them. And so please tell us what you'd like us to do, what's important to you, and we will try very hard to implement those suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Al Benson, the third, and Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine. He's Associate Director for Clinical Investigations, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson is going to address an overview of colorectal cancer, the current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and the importance of clinical trials. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and it's a pleasure to join everyone today. Colon cancer is one of the most frequently diagnosed cancers, particularly in the United States, and therefore it has been a very important disease for which screening programs have been developed. Most colon cancers develop from abnormal outgrowths in the colon referred to as polyps. And if we are able to diagnose and remove polyps early, we have the best opportunity to try to prevent cancer from forming in the first place. So screening programs are very important. Another important component of screening and evaluating patients with the diagnosis of colon cancer is taking a detailed family history. And so we encourage patients to know their family history because there are individuals who carry an inherited risk of developing colon cancer. And knowing that risk and being able to test for such is important because it can influence treatment strategies, including surgical procedures, and also it influences how frequently we perform tests such as colonoscopy. We also look at other risk factors. We know that families who have a history of colon cancer, it may not be inherited, but a history of such carries a higher risk that other family members may also develop colon cancer. The colon and rectum represent the last 5 feet or so of the intestinal tract, And although the colon and rectum are both part of the large intestine, we do have different strategies in terms of how we treat individuals. First of all, the majority of people who present each year with colon cancer are people who should undergo surgery to remove the primary colon cancer, and that is feasible in the majority of people we see. With that surgical procedure and pathologic review of the tumor and colon specimen and the lymph nodes that are included in the surgical specimen, we are able to do what we call stage the cancer. Staging the cancer is important because with staging, we determine who might need additional therapy and who may not. There are four stages of colorectal cancer, stages 1, 2, 3, and 4. For individuals with colon cancer who have stage 1 disease, those individuals usually require surgery only and then no further treatment whatsoever. For stage 2 colon cancer, and what that refers to is the depth of invasion of the cancer into the intestinal bowel wall. And the pathologists help us determine what that depth of invasion is. The stage 2 individual does not have lymph nodes that are involved with cancer. And for most individuals with stage 2 colon cancer, surgery alone is sufficient. What has evolved, and Dr. Saltz may mention this a little bit more, is a biological test we can do on a tumor called microsatellite instability. It's estimated that perhaps 15 to 20% of all colon cancer patients with stage 2 disease have microsatellite instability, and that carries a very good prognosis, and it's reassuring that those individuals do not require additional therapy, including chemotherapy. For stage 3 disease, however, those individuals have lymph nodes that have been involved with the colon cancer tumor cells, and those are individuals for whom we do recommend postoperative chemotherapy. We are giving chemotherapy not to prevent recurrence, but rather to treat what we presume are tumor cells that may be circulating in the bloodstream, for example, but we do not have the ability to detect those cells. And by giving additional therapy with chemotherapy, the goal is to destroy those tumor cells. For most individuals, that includes therapy for about 6 months, and the most commonly used chemotherapy drugs for people with stage 3 colon cancer are oxaliplatin and 5-FU. For rectal cancer, there is a little bit different strategy. The pelvis is quite a narrow part of the body, and although the surgeons can typically remove a rectal cancer tumor, there is a higher risk that there may be tumor cells that remain, although not detected. Unfortunately, if those tumor cells remain, they can begin to grow and cause significant difficulty in the pelvis. So one way to reduce the risk of what we refer to as local recurrence is to combine chemotherapy, usually with 5-FU or an oral drug capecitabine, with radiation, which is given for about 5 weeks prior to the actual surgery to remove the rectal cancer. By doing this approach with chemotherapy and radiation, it often makes the surgeon's job a bit easier, and it's clearly been shown to reduce the risk of local recurrence. After surgery, particularly for people with stage 2 and 3 rectal cancer, we consider additional chemotherapy. Again, the goal is to destroy any small numbers of tumor cells that may remain, and thus that is a standard of care. For people with stage 4 colorectal cancer, that means that their colon cancer tumor cells have traveled to another organ in the body or to lymph nodes, for example, in other locations in the body, or in tissue planes, for example, in the abdominal cavity. For those individuals who present with their colon cancer and may have metastatic disease at that time, many of those individuals may not need an immediate surgery, but are considered to begin chemotherapy. Particularly over the last 10 years, there has been significant developments in terms of treating people with stage 4 rectal cancer, including a number of drugs, which most typically include oxaliplatin, another chemotherapy drug called irinotecan, the drug I previously mentioned, 5-FU, as well as what we call targeted therapies, which Dr. Saltz will address. It's important when we diagnose someone with stage 4 colon cancer that we think carefully about a plan of care over time, because many individuals will benefit from using multiple chemotherapy drugs over time to certainly help control symptoms and to prolong life for as long as possible. Another critical development that's received a lot of attention is we now know that it's possible to further enhance the care of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer if they have tumor deposits in areas that can be surgically removed. So the most common site where we actually can selectively remove tumors include tumors that occur in the liver. And so when we treat people with stage 4 disease now and begin with chemotherapy, we carefully monitor people over time, looking for those individuals who actually may be able to go to surgery and remove spots on the liver, for example. After that type of surgery, some people go on and continue chemotherapy and are carefully monitored over time. I think an important message is that these treatment strategies have been developed over recent times, and they have developed because we have been able to conduct clinical trials in the United States. In oncology, we generally view clinical trials as a component of the standard of care for people with a given cancer, and certainly we conduct many, many clinical trials for people with colorectal cancer. It is through this process that we are able to introduce new treatment approaches for patients and critically gather information as to how well these new treatments work, how safe they are. It's very critical that we understand what side effects may develop. And therefore, people on clinical trials not only have a defined treatment approach, but are carefully monitored for side effects and then monitored over time to determine what are the results from such a treatment. unfortunately, in the United States, only a few percentage of people actually participate in these clinical trials. And that is of concern because that can delay the progress we make as we introduce new treatment options for patients. And virtually every agent that I just mentioned in terms of the chemotherapy drugs and the agents that Dr. Saltz will mention were developed because there were individual patients who participated in these clinical trials. We conduct clinical trials through a variety of different sources. Some come from our own institutions. Dr. Saltz and I both conduct trials at our own centers that we've designed, but we also participate with the National Cancer Institute, including very large trials available to people across the country, and also with the pharmaceutical industry that also collaborates with oncologists across the country to offer trials to patients. Trials are available throughout the United States and include participating physicians both at large academic centers, such as where Dr. Saltz and I are located, but also throughout community centers. And so it's very important that people ask their physicians if they're a potential candidate for a clinical trial, because it may be an opportunity for people to receive a promising new treatment. I did mention that currently we continue to conduct clinical trials, and one of the most important areas of research now and is included in most of the trials that we conduct is obtaining actual tumor tissues from individual patients. Often these are tissues that are already in pathology departments because people have already had their surgery. But these tumor tissues are important for us to better understand the biology of cancers and to develop treatments that will also address the biological characteristics that we identify when we study tumors. We've come to learn that in a disease like colon cancer, this does not represent one type of tumor. Colon cancer is actually a collection of many different types of tumor cells, which may require different treatment strategies. And a big component of what we're now doing in our clinical trials is to study this biology so we understand these different types of tumor cells, the different genetic profiles of these tumors, as well as biological pathways. And only by understanding these biological phenomenon through the clinical research we do will we be able to further improve the treatment opportunities for patients. And that concludes some of the highlights I wanted to stress today. I know it's a great deal of material to absorb, but at least to cover some of the critical areas of colorectal cancer.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Benson. Just a really remarkable presentation, extraordinary and very helpful, lots of information and very informative, but presented in a way that is very understandable. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Leonard Saltz, and Dr. Saltz is Acting Chief Gastrointestinal Oncology Service, Head Colorectal Oncology Section, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Saltz is really going to talk about predicting response to treatment or the role of personalized medicine. He's going to spend time talking about the KRAS gene and targeted cancer therapies, and then controlling symptoms and discomfort and pain, quality of life concerns, and communicating with your healthcare team. So it is my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Saltz, and I welcome Dr. Saltz to the program.
Thank you very much. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you today. I'm going to focus my comments for this part of the program mostly on metastatic or stage 4 disease, because I think that's where a lot of the topics that I have been asked to comment on really come into play. Let me start by talking about personalized medicine, because that's a buzzword that everybody is starting to hear all over the place, and I think it's largely misunderstood for many reasons. One reason is that I'm not sure that anyone has really defined it all that rigorously. What most of us think about when we talk about personalized medicine is starting to make use of some of the information that Dr. Benson talked about at the end of his comments, recognizing that for any type of cancer, but particularly for a common disease like colorectal cancer, that the topic colorectal cancer covers hundreds, if not thousands, of different diseases. And we know from experience that different therapies work or don't work to different degrees in different people. Personalized medicine is trying to figure out why, trying to be able to tell in advance on the basis of a molecular understanding of each individual patient's tumor what drug is likely to be beneficial and what drug is likely not to be beneficial, or what drug is likely to have a lot of side effects and what drug is not likely to have a lot of side effects for that particular person. Because remember, we talk a lot in cancer about statistics. We may say the chance of a drug causing a response is X percent. Let's pull a number out of thin air and say 50%. Well, it's never 50% for an individual. For any individual, it either works or it doesn't. It's 0% or 100%. Personalized medicine is trying to figure out before we give the person the drug what we can expect to happen. And in that context, a very good example of real-time use of personalized medicine is the KRAS gene. KRAS is a gene that codes for a protein that helps transmit signals within the cell that tell that cell to grow and survive. And of course, when we're giving anti-cancer therapy, we're trying to block signals like that because we want the cell to neither grow nor survive. It turns out that about 40% of patients with colorectal cancers have a specific mutation in the gene, not in the person, but in the tumor, in the KRAS gene within the tumor. And if that mutation is present, then some of the newer drugs that we bring to bear on these tumors cannot work. So specifically, there are two antibodies that go by the generic names cetuximab and panitumumab. Their trade names, which you may be more familiar with, are Erbitux and Vectibix. And these are antibodies that block a receptor on the tumor cell surface and block the start of these grow and survive signals. If the cell has a normal, non-mutated KRAS gene, then those drugs have a reasonable chance of helping. But we know that if that KRAS gene is mutated, then those drugs will not work in that patient. They still can cause side effects, as all drugs can. And so, of course, we'd never want to give a drug to a patient that has virtually no chance of helping and has the chance of doing some kind of harm. So we are now in the routine of doing specific genetic analysis on each patient's tumor to determine the status of the KRAS gene, and only utilizing the anti-EGFR agents, the cetuximab and panitumumab, in those patients that have a wild-type gene. So that is one example of personalized medicine. Now, to some degree, that's what I call an exclusionary marker. It excludes people from the drug by telling us in advance that it won't work. What we would really love to have is what I call inclusionary markers, which are markers that would tell us that a particular drug will or is exceedingly likely to work. We don't really have those yet in colorectal cancer, but a lot of the research that Dr. Benson was talking about before, both at his center and at mine and in the large cooperative group studies that we work with, is focused on trying to develop those kinds of personalized gene signatures or markers that will tell us who to treat, who not to treat, and when to perhaps think about using drugs that we otherwise wouldn't bring to bear in colorectal cancer patients, but that because of some particular constellation of genetic alterations and mutations, a particular patient may be vulnerable to that approach, or a particular tumor, rather, may be vulnerable to that approach. So I think it's important to understand that KRAS testing is something that any patient with metastatic colorectal cancer should expect to have done on their tumor, because it is important in making decisions as far as what therapies would be available. It's not something that we're able to use in the earlier stage disease, in the stage 1, 2, and 3 patients, because the drugs that are affected by this particular personalized marker aren't used in those areas. They haven't shown benefit in those areas. They're useful only in the more advanced patients. So with that, let me move on a little bit to the issues of symptom control and quality of life concerns. Now, symptoms come in two basic areas. One is symptoms due to the tumor itself, and the other is symptoms due to the treatment, or what we would call side effects from the treatment. I think it's important to recognize that chemotherapy is one of the scarier words in the English language, and it's scary because everybody is worried about side effects. The side effect that probably comes to mind when you say the word chemotherapy most is nausea. And it's important to understand that our concept of nausea and nausea with chemotherapy really started decades ago. And I would argue that one of the most important advances in cancer care in the last 30 years is the very substantial improvement in anti-nausea medicines. And patients can now expect to get very effective anti-nausea medicines prior to receiving those drugs that are likely to cause this problem. I'm not saying that nausea is no longer an issue. I'm saying that it is a much, much, much smaller and less frequent issue than it used to be. And it's important to understand that it's very reasonable to hope and expect, when embarking on a chemotherapy for colon cancer, that nausea will be either no concern or a very, very rare and minor concern. We do have other side effects that we have to help people cope with. A lot of our drugs cause diarrhea. Some of our drugs, particularly a drug called oxaliplatin that we use very frequently in this disease, cause a side effect called neuropathy. That's a numbness and tingling in the hands and feet, and a cold sensitivity in the hands, the feet, and the throat. Now, to some degree, because we have a number of drugs to choose from, we can go back to the concept of personalized medicine by talking with each patient, discussing the different side effects of the different drugs, and making individualized choices based on which side effect profile is more or less acceptable to an individual patient. So for someone that particularly works with their hands or works in situations where they're exposed to cold, if they work outside, the choice of oxaliplatin might be something that we might save until later in the course of management. Irinotecan, which is another drug that we often use instead of oxaliplatin, is more likely to cause hair loss. And that may or may not matter to an individual, but I think it probably matters to people more than they care to admit, either to their doctors or to themselves. And it's important to be honest with yourself and with your doctor in discussing those concerns, because hair loss has issues of privacy and issues of self-image that I think are extremely important for a lot of people when they're going through a cancer treatment process and they're living and coping with their cancer on a regular basis. That brings us to the issue of communicating with your healthcare team. I think the most important aspect of a doctor-patient relationship is open two-way communication. It's really important for patients to understand that there's no such thing as a foolish question, that it doesn't matter if the question's been asked before, if you're not sure of the answer, and that ultimately our job as healthcare providers, as doctors, as nurses, as physicians' assistants, and so on, is to try to help the patient understand what his or her options are, what his or her choices are, what his or her situation is, and for that, we have to work to try to anticipate what questions might be and to provide information as best we can, but then patients have to feel comfortable to bring up questions and concerns as they occur and to communicate those concerns in a way that we understand, we the healthcare providers understand what issues we still need to cover. One of the things I often caution patients about is it's human nature to think of three questions on the way home from the doctor's office. It's human nature to think of a question at midnight and forget it in the morning. And it's human nature to think of questions on the way in the doctor's office, into the doctor's office, and then forget them when you're in a face-to-face encounter. What this means is it's really important when you think of a question to write it down. It's important to keep the ability to write something down, whether you do it the old-fashioned way with paper and pen, or whether you keep it on your handheld device, your iPhone or BlackBerry or whatever. But make a list of questions as they occur to you. Go through them when you have the chance to be talking with your doctor or healthcare provider so that those issues can be addressed. Again, there are many, many issues that we could discuss with the topics that I was given. However, I don't want to overuse the time because there are many people on the line, and I want to make sure that we leave adequate time for questions. Therefore, I'm going to stop now. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Saltz. That was really a wonderful presentation, and also just the instructions to everyone about the being sure that they have permission to ask those questions and to kind of keep a list of them. And I think your comments probably resonated for everybody on the call when these questions occur and then when you're in the doctor's office, how hard it is to remember them. So I hope everybody heard these remarks. Do make those notes and bring them with you. And your doctors do want to answer your questions. Thank you. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. Our next speaker is Rachel Murphy. Rachel is a registered dietitian. She's senior clinical dietitian at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Murphy is going to address the nutritional concerns and tips that all of you really struggle with. So I'm going to turn the program over to Ms. Murphy.
Thank you, Carolyn. Hello there. I'd like to start out by talking about some of the nutrition goals for colorectal cancer, which are to prevent or reverse poor nutrition in order to maintain scheduled cancer treatments like surgery, chemotherapy, and/or radiation therapy. Also to manage symptoms and side effects that can occur from the cancer itself, as well as from cancer treatments also, and to maximize quality of life. Now, some of the general nutrition recommendations for colorectal cancer are to drink plenty of fluids to stay hydrated. A general rule of thumb for this is about 8 to 10 8-ounce cups of fluid per day. Consume adequate amounts of protein like beans, peas, poultry, fish, dairy products, which can help maintain muscle mass and aid in healing. Choose nutrient-dense foods like fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. Daily fruit and vegetable intake should be colorful. Think of the rainbow. This will help to maximize cancer-fighting nutrients. Limit alcohol consumption and stay as active as you can. I'd like to make a brief note that some people with colorectal cancer may be at risk for bowel obstruction or blockage of the intestines is another term or way to describe it. Generally, avoiding a high-fiber diet with lots of roughage would be recommended in this case, but this can vary from person to person, so please talk with your doctor or dietitian for more specific diet information on that. Next, I'd like to talk about the symptoms and side effects with colorectal cancer, which are poor appetite and early satiety. Nausea and vomiting can also be one. Diarrhea, constipation, as well as gas and bloating. So if you're experiencing poor appetite and early satiety, which means getting full quickly, try consuming small but frequent meals throughout the day. Avoid overly sweet foods or liquids, as well as greasy, fried, or highly spiced foods. Maintain good oral care is important. And you can use liquid meal replacements like smoothies or supplement drinks as well for a small meal. If you're experiencing nausea with or without vomiting, try eliminating offending odors. Try room temperature or cooler foods because they tend to give off fewer odors. Drink liquids in a cup with a lid if smells are triggering the nausea. Try dry foods like crackers, cereal, or toast. Try sour or tart flavors like lemon drops or ginger candies. And as Dr. Saltz mentioned, using the anti-nausea medication as prescribed by your doctor to adequately control the nausea is very important and vital to controlling that nausea. If you're experiencing diarrhea, you may want to limit or avoid some of the following. Dairy if it makes the diarrhea worse, but usually yogurt and buttermilk are okay. Fiber like dried beans, peas, seeds, whole grain products, and raw fruits and vegetables. Greasy and spicy foods. Foods sweetened with sugar, alcohol, and sugar-sweetened beverages. If you're experiencing diarrhea, you may want to increase the following. Foods with live, active culture yogurt. High potassium and sodium foods or beverages to replace lost electrolytes. And extra fluids in general to replace losses. If you're experiencing constipation, you'd want to increase fiber intake with high-fiber cereals, whole grains such as brown rice, 100% whole grain breads, whole wheat pastas, as well as beans, legumes, and fresh fruits and vegetables. Drinking adequate amounts of fluid daily. And drinking some of your fluids warm can help as well. If you're experiencing gas and bloating, you may want to limit or avoid some of the following typical gas-producing items, such as cruciferous vegetables like broccoli and cabbage or the cabbage family, beans, eggs, garlic, onion, and carbonated beverages as well. Note that dairy can cause gas for some people also. I last would like to talk briefly about guidelines for supplementation. You really want to try to avoid megadoses of any vitamins or minerals. But generally, a standard over-the-counter daily multivitamin mineral supplement is generally okay, but you can also talk to your doctor about this just to confirm. And finally, correcting any vitamin or mineral deficiencies under the care of a doctor or dietitian. And just know that you can always meet with a dietitian for more personalized information, as every person's nutritional needs and concerns are different depending on the type and stage and treatment of the colorectal cancer. Thank you for allowing me to be a part of this teleconference. I'll pass the line back to Carolyn. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Rachel, for a wonderful presentation and also for your being a part of this. It really is very helpful. You were very specific and helpful to people in terms of nutritional tips, so thank you. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. And Elizabeth is an oncology social worker and a program coordinator at Cancer Care. And she is going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care. And it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Liz.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with colorectal cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources, and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. joining a social work is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a people with colorectal cancer support group over the phone as well as online for people with colorectal cancer and their caregivers, as well as a unique young adult caregivers group. If you are interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our helpline at 1-800-813-HOPE-4673 or on our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is a very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information about your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. As we have learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and to get your arms around, and our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Well, thank you very much, Liz, for a wonderful, wonderful presentation, also for identifying all the services that people can access from Cancer Care. Now, we do have time for questions, and we have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Janitha to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to have the questions begin. We'll try to take as many of your questions as possible, and if we do not get to your question, please realize that you can call us at Cancer Care, and our staff will then address your questions. So, Janitha, could you explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and all of our speakers are on board so that we can begin.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question is from Ron R. Your question, please.
For a rectal cancer, prior to surgery, sometimes neoadjuvant therapy includes radiation in various dosages, 30 grays, 45 grays, 60 grays. My question is data out there yet to show whether the higher dosage is more effective prior to surgery or not? And secondarily to that, what is the long-term of secondary cancers after a cure might be affected for secondary cancers appearing due to the higher or lower radiation dosages?
Well, Ron, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Benson if you could address that question.
So for most patients with rectal cancer, the dosing of radiation has become fairly standardized, and it's generally around the 50 gray area, and that is administered generally daily, Monday through Fridays, weekends off, and it generally takes about 5 weeks to complete. There are people who need an additional boost of radiation, and this is decided by an expert radiation oncologist who, prior to administering the radiation, has done a very detailed planning as to where the radiation field where the radiation should be administered. And the factors that are included in this decision is location of the tumor, perhaps size of the tumor, if there are lymph nodes involved, for example. Although in general we have a fairly standardized way to do this, the expertise of the radiation oncologist is critical to carefully design the appropriate field of treatment. And the radiation oncologist works hand in hand with the medical oncologist and the surgeon, which is absolutely critical when a person is newly diagnosed with rectal cancer, to best design a treatment approach. In terms of the risk of the radiation per se, and secondary cancers in that radiation area, this is a phenomenon where we actually don't see a lot of extra risk with new cancers in the radiation area. What people are at risk is obtaining or experiencing a brand new colorectal cancer, and that's the purpose of careful surveillance over time with colonoscopy. The primary treatment we give when a person is diagnosed does not prevent a brand new colon cancer from developing, which is why we have to do screening. We are very aware that there can be long-term consequences from radiation, and so that's one of the reasons in our clinical trials for rectal cancer, we are following individuals for many, many years, and we are looking to see if there is the development of additional cancers, and certainly if there are long-term side effects from the radiation.
Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants. Is ablation of metastasized tumors a consideration with colon cancer? Dr. Salt, could you address that?
Ablation usually done with radiofrequency these days, so it's called radiofrequency ablation, is a technique that can be used when there is a small number of relatively small size metastases in locations that are amenable for this approach. So these are usually either liver or lung metastases, and this is a technique that basically sticks a special probe into the tumor and creates a radio frequency or microwave or electric field that ends up essentially destroying the tumor with heat, essentially cooking a sphere, a ball-shaped area around the tumor. It requires, of course, specialized equipment and specialized expertise, and it should be done only by people that are experienced and well-trained in this approach. It is not something that we have evidence to support using this approach in situations where you cannot ablate everything. In other words, the idea of, well, there's 12 tumors, but I can ablate 6 of them, let's go ahead and do that, maybe it'll help. That's probably not the right way to use this technique, and unfortunately we do see situations where that's being done for patients, but I think that's exposing people to risk without really much evidence that would be beneficial. So it is one of the many tools that we do consider when trying to figure out the best course of care for each individual patient. In centers that have surgical expertise to remove liver or lung lesions, usually that approach would be preferred over ablation, but sometimes due to a particular location, ablation may be a better choice.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you very much. Trinitha, our next question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Amaril S. Your question, please.
Does doing a colonoscopy aggravate the colon and cause inflammation, resulting in future cancers of the area? And I say this because I had a colonoscopy done in September of 2008, and 6 weeks later I was diagnosed with advanced prostate cancer, and I don't know if one had anything to do with the other. And, I just want to know, doing future colonoscopies, will that aggravate any other organs in the area that could cause cancer growth?
Thank you. That is an excellent question, and I think it sometimes is on people's minds, and I'm going to ask Dr. Benson if you could address that question. Thank you, in a general way.
So both colon and prostate cancer are unfortunately very common cancers, and it's not at all unusual for us to see individuals with more than one type of cancer. So As a GI oncologist who treats colorectal cancer, I have many men who also have prostate cancer. So these are very independent phenomenon. Sometimes when people are being evaluated, whether it's a screening test or some other medical problem that's being evaluated, it's an opportunity to uncover other medical problems. And when that happens, then, of course, the newly diagnosed problem must be addressed. Colonoscopy is generally a very safe procedure. There is a risk. It's a small risk, but there is a risk, for example, of perforation of the intestine. But it's not going to cause a prostate cancer or cause other irritations of the intestinal tract.
Thank you. And our next question, Shiva?
Thank you. Our next question is from Carrie Q. Your question, please.
The question is, I can appreciate Dr. Solce's emphasis on an open two-way communication with the medical team. And I was just wondering, in terms of for the patient, when would it be appropriate, or when can a patient think about accessing trials? Simply because usually that, the impression that you have in terms of trials is that it's something that you try towards the end of a series of protocols. But I'm wondering if you were just curious about the trials, would you, you know, at what moment or how would this be broached with the medical team?
That's a great question. Dr. Saltz, yes.
Yeah, I would hope that oncologists are bringing up the issues of clinical trials at every stage of intervention, because there are usually trials that are available for patients with previously untreated cancers, as well as with cancers that have exhausted standard therapies. So I think it's always appropriate for that discussion to be had, and it's always a fair question for patients to ask if it's not brought up by the doctor. Sometimes the answer may be your situation is not one for which we have access to a clinical trial, or it may be that for whatever reason your either cancer situation or medical situation may make you ineligible for a clinical trial, but it's always an appropriate discussion to be having, because as Dr. Benson emphasized, it's good for the individual patient, and it's good for cancer patients as a group for everyone to be aware of their clinical trial options and so that they can consider participation.
That's such an important area in terms of that clinical trials are really, they are a part of the options of care. Is that how you would phrase it?
The way that I and my colleagues approach this in our practices here at Memorial Sloan Kettering is whenever we see a patient, we first try to outline for the patient what we view is the situation and the most appropriate standard care option, and then present investigational options that might be available as an alternative, and then discuss the pros and cons.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been outstanding. This has been an amazing call, and one that we would want to offer again with this terrific team here. And I also want to thank all of you who posed such wonderful questions, really, that helped us to kind of further elaborate on issues that were of concern. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. And so I do want to again remind all of you of all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. And there are many services, of course, that Liz Ezra has already gone over with you that you can access. We have a staff of about 40 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services, from practical and financial assistance to a chance to talk with one of our social workers' counseling services, or if you have questions, again, after today's program, you can certainly call our 800 number and ask to speak to one of our social workers. They can help address your questions. We also offer support groups, and also to make them more easy for you to get to, they are on the telephone and online, so that with all the different regions of the world and country that you are, that you can all participate in those kind of programs. And we also have, of course, many of these education workshops and materials and booklets that we make available to all of you. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, we don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with colorectal cancer or with cancer or with any issues that you're concerned about. We want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and that you can access services from Cancer Care and all the other organizations that we have provided you information about. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect, and have a wonderful day.